The Lord be with you. Have you ever read the book of Proverbs? Maybe since we've been talking so much about wisdom literature, you decided to read the book of Proverbs. And that book says a lot of stuff like this. For the waywardness of the simple will kill them, and the complacency of fools will destroy them. But whoever listens to me will live in safety and be at ease without fear of harm. The book of Proverbs is full of all sorts of advice. A penny saved is a penny earned. Don't smoke and don't chew and don't go with girls that do. Sensible shoes make sense. Do these things, live this way, practice integrity and wisdom, and it'll all work out. You'll avoid bankruptcy, lung disease, and bunions. Sometimes Proverbs sounds like pithy bits of advice that they give to those silver spoon Ivy League fraternity members while they're backslapping over martinis and shrimp cocktail at the country club. Obtain a position in a reputable firm. Work hard and manage your portfolio, and you will afford yourself an apartment on the Upper East Side, and your fashion model wife will paint her nails in your house at the Hamptons. Well, there is some truth in Proverbs. Work and integrity are important. Giving attention to our lives is critical. Honesty and virtue really does have its benefits. There comes a point when all this tidy advice starts to sound distant and cold and sterile and detached from real life, like an experiment conducted under glass that has very different results when applied out in the field. Eventually, we reach that point when somebody has to interject and say, yeah, it will all work out up until the point when it really doesn't. Thank you very much. We need some real life wisdom in the middle of all those proverbs and platitudes. We need a voice that challenges those conventions and assertions. We need somebody like the writer of the book of Job. Job and Proverbs are both books full of wisdom, but they work with such different starting points. Proverbs commends us to live the best life we can, to follow God and thrive. But Job starts with the premise that a person could live this way, choosing the life of Proverbs, making all the right choices, doing all the right things, and still find themselves in a world of hurt and suffering. The investments that didn't pay off, the plans that didn't work out, the children that didn't come home. Job asks, so now what? What do we do as people of faith in a world that hurts us? Can we trust? Can we worship a God who lets these things happen to us? Should we worship a God who lets these things happen to us, even when we've made all the right moves and done all the right things? Job is a book of poetry. Poetry that asks some of the most primal questions of theology. And if you talk to any of the experts in linguistic prose, they'll tell you that the writer of Job was a virtuoso, arguably the most talented poet in all of Scripture. He had a unique capacity of descriptive language and imagery. He would play on words, string together phrases and unique mixtures of terms. He had an enormous vocabulary and imagination. So I know what you're all thinking. Job is basically the Eminem of the Bible. We were all thinking it. I just had to say it. He's spitting rhymes, angry and beautiful, shocking and visceral, sprawling 42 chapters theological argument in poetry. A poet spilling his creative guts with a driving backbeat that thumps in your chest. Even after it's been translated and retranslated and transcribed, Job retains so much of its gritty power. But today we are in Job chapter 1. And we don't get any of the poetry. Job 1 is the prologue. It's the scene setter for the whole story. It's the setup. In today's passage, we mostly just hear the voice of the narrator. Now, if you're a fan of Wes Anderson's precious little movies, like Royal Tenenbaums, or Moonrise Kingdom, which is on Netflix right now, or the Grand Budapest Hotel, you know exactly what we're working with. We start off with some tight close-ups of our characters. And, of course, Job is played by Bill Murray. Job's wife is Angelica Houston. We see shots of his family and his servants and his animals. And there's some framing, and every now and then we see someone scribbling a note with a quill pen, maybe, on parchment. And then we see a big shot that's really just a miniature of Job's house and his farm, maybe. And the narrator is Alec Baldwin. Once upon a time, or as the writer puts it, a man there was in the land of Uz, Job his name. And the man was blameless and upright and feared God and shunned evil. Okay, we get it. This is a fable. It's a fairy story in a make-believe place called Uz. It's a made-up story. It's a made-up story, just the sort of story that happens all the time. Job is a man of spectacular wealth. He's the richest man in the world, actually. And he has a perfect family and a clean track record. We get it. We get it. This is as good as it gets. And then in our next scene, the narrator takes us on this trip to this throne room in heaven. And there's this sort of heavenly adversary there. Apparently in this story, for some reason, God keeps this critic around the office. It's a creature who roams the earth looking for trouble, looking to criticize everyone and trip them up. And God says to the adversary, "Have you paid heed to my servant Job? There is none like him on earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and shuns evil." And the adversary answers, "Does Job fear God for nothing? Haven't you spoon-fed every good thing to him? He only lives this way because you protect him. He's only a good man because of all these perks." And then the adversary says, "Reach out your hand. Strike all he has. Will he not curse your face?" So for the purpose of this story, God, in some sort of sick wager, unleashes Mr. the adversary on poor old Job. And things are about to get heavy. Because back in the land of Uz, all of Job's children are celebrating in the home of their big brother. And there's wine that they're drinking and probably meat that they're roasting. And they're playing bocce ball on the lawn. It's like one of those big Italian weddings. And life is pretty sweet. What could go wrong? I mean, this is a great party. But then Job receives word from four messengers who each arrive to recite a terrible version of a new horror that they have witnessed. Your holdings, your wealth, your family. They've been taken by bands of marauders or destroyed by natural catastrophes. It's all gone, Job. All of it. And I alone escape to tell you. When we turn on the news each night, we watch these blow-dry talking heads, messengers under studio lights, bringing word of terrible calamity for all sorts of people in the world. And it's amazing how quickly those real-life stories turn into little blips of trivia. just another piece of the ever-changing, content-driven news cycle. How can we absorb it all? How can we process it all? And how many Jobs are there in the world right now? How many of Job's sons and daughters? One of the most popular websites in the world, and probably one of my favorite, is by a photographer named Brian Stanton. He's got a website called Humans of New York. And he just takes pictures of interesting people, and then he puts quotes from them underneath each picture. And they're pretty great. Lately, though, he's been making his way around Europe. It's not just Humans of New York anymore. It's Humans of the Earth. And he's been taking pictures of people that have been escaping the war in Syria. And this week he posted a photograph of a man sitting on a little plastic chair in a refugee camp in Greece. And he's got his arm around two boys. And a piece of the quote underneath reads, "I saw the army burn my neighbor's house. They set it on fire and took photographs while it burned. And the next day I saw the same house on TV, except the headline claimed that it had been destroyed by terrorists. I was eating with my entire family when suddenly we heard the sound of a car outside. Soldiers kicked down the door and they tied my hands behind my back. My children were screaming and the soldiers said, 'We know you are working for the opposition. You are a terrorist.' And I told them, 'Please, we are poor people. We have done nothing. We are trying to live.' I never thought I would see my family again." How can we digest these stories? How can we carry the great weight of these stories that are so overwhelming and never seem to stop? We also know, too, that Job is not just about stories of people in far-off places. Often this is our story, stories of grief and loss, stories of broken dreams and broken hearts. And there we just get to live in the nakedness and the shock and the sorrow as human beings. Humans of the earth. And before we can talk about any of our solutions, before we can give voice to any of our troubles, before we can put together any answers or reasons or be a part of any solutions, before we can draft any theological explanations or doctrines, before we can do any of this, we're just people living in a world that can take so much from us. A world that is full of adversaries of so many kinds. And too often, we don't have any words. We don't have any advice. We don't have any solutions. We've run out of platitudes and catchy sayings, and the ones that we do speak sound so empty and hollow. If the question is, can we trust and worship a God who lets these things happen to us? Then I propose there is room and time and space for silent witness, for speechlessness in the face of the adversary. Mary Jane already said it today. Silence is the first language of prayer. I could say a place like that, that silent, wordless, vulnerable human space, a place like that, is a good place to start. Actually, it's the only place to start as we prepare our hearts to ask God the hardest questions of all, the hardest questions that we can dream up. As we bear witness to the suffering of our global friends and neighbors, brothers and sisters who find themselves speechless, troubled, displaced, and as we share our own very real stories, stories that invite participation, stories that overwhelm us and leave us speechless. I propose that there is a time before we speak, a time to sit, a time to listen, a time to breathe, a time to hear our own hearts beat. As we groan, as we gather ourselves, as we just try and live. In this raw story that gives shape to the very questions that we still don't have words for. This is just the prologue. It's the setup. We have 3 more weeks as we travel with Job. And believe me, in the chapters ahead, Job gets to raise his voice. Scripture is filled with passion and poetry, asking God the hardest questions, naming the shape of our disappointment and our frustrations. This is a journey of mystery, and these answers do not come easy. And with the poet Job, we will get to navigate these deep questions, troubling problems that shape our life of faith. These are stories we get to tell. But before all that, let's take the time to live in the long silence that precedes it.